Sure. I'd like to welcome everyone this morning. Glad to see you. All bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Like to have take an opportunity quickly this morning for our members to introduce themselves, briefly share some of the interests that they have in transportation, how it might affect their district, and if we can do it as briefly as possible, so we don't take up a lot of our committee time this morning. I'd like to do that now. Representative Nelson, would you like to start?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to let you know how honored I am to be selected to serve on this Transportation Committee. The importance of transportation to our state is undeniably one of the most critical issues and highly important. I spent 24 years of my last 30 years in transportation, but I wasn't too concerned about roads. I was more concerned about clouds as I retired in 1998 as the Senior Vice President of Evergreen International Aviation. However, at one time in our lives, we were the second largest trucking company in Oregon in that, so we were involved in, of course, forestry and harvesting timber. I am from District 29, and which is McMinnville, Daniel County, Newburgh, Jim Hill, Carlton, Lafayette, and transportation is very important to us in that we have a bottleneck and congestion in the Dundee-Newburgh area, and also because of the low job growth, we find it critical that we come up with some solution to that congestion problem as soon as possible, and also continue to focus on safety on Highway 18 and other safety corridors. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Ben Berger, would you?
Yes. For the last 8 years, I have been the mayor of Coos Bay, Oregon, and as the mayor of the city, we have been very involved in transportation, and on the South Coast, it is certainly a major interest to my constituents. I also was a member of the Southwest Oregon Act, and have been working with prioritizing transportation projects and taking a look seriously at the kind of funding needed over a long period of time. I'm very interested in helping on the committee to work to come to some type of creative thinking about long-term funding for transportation. I'm very happy to be able to serve on this committee.
Thank you very much. Representative Donner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My district is 38, Julie Giannello's old district. And my two main concerns in the highway are 214 and the Dundee bypass. And so I'm already working with a lot of you folks, Grace and others at ODOT. And we're excited about it and looking forward to it.
Thank you. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Chairman Starr. My House District is House District 4, which makes up the Central Oregon Coast. During the decade of the 90s, the economic boom that and good times that took place in the Portland area and through the Willamette Valley didn't necessarily extend all the way to the coast. With the downturn in the natural resource-based industries there, we become very, very heavily dependent and almost totally dependent upon our tourist industry, and transportation plays a very large role in getting those people to the coast to ensure that we still have that industry there. And so I have a great deal of interest in all phases of our transportation system, our ports, our airlines, railroad, and particularly the highways. And I'm looking forward to the opportunity to serve.
Thank you. And Brian Hipstein Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
And I feel like I just left my last committee because Representative Nelson and I sit in exactly this configuration on our other committee assignment.
And I'm the one who's fortunate.
I'm Diane Rosenbaum, representing House District 14, primarily Southeast Portland and a little of Northeast Portland, so a very urban district. I have really not a strong background in transportation, although I did serve on the Revenue Committee last session, so I can attest that I spent many, many hours hearing about the weight mile tax, and can't say today that I fully understand how it works. Probably have some familiarity because of the revenue and funding issues. For my district, I think that there's a strong concern about just metropolitan gridlock, about the ways in which transportation needs to be looked at holistically, not just as cars, but also alternative transportation options. There's a strong interest in bicycle transportation, there's a strong interest in incentives to get people out of their cars, because I think people believe that we can't just build our way out of the metropolitan problem, and clearly with the funding situation we're facing, I think we do need to look creatively. So I'm looking forward to working with you and the other members of the committee.
Super, thank you. Representative Devlin.
Well, maybe the chair was reading my mind. I started working on transportation issues in the 80s at the local and regional level. Then worked on the regional level in the 90s, and actually was a member of this committee in the last session, and chair of the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation at one time. So I'm now starting into my third decade in dealing with transportation issues. And I don't know if I really wanted to be here this session or not. But I think the issues are very important. They're more complex than they appear sometimes on the surface. They involve a lot more stakeholders than most people realize. And but I think that they just don't seem to go away. I mean, there are problems that are difficult to resolve, but as soon as you've resolved one problem, a new set of problems arise.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Dillon. Representative Krupp excused himself for a few minutes, and he comes back. We'll have him introduce himself. At this time, I'd like to introduce our staff. Our committee administrator is John Leon, and our committee assistant is Kate Campo. I'd like to welcome both of them. They're new to committee assignments. John has been in the building before. Our committee staff is here to serve our committee members, all of us. If you have a question, if you have a need of some sort, feel free to pick up the phone and call our committee staff to assist you if you need help with research. Basically, anything to do with this committee, if you need some help, they're here to serve all of us, and they would welcome that kind of inquiry. And at this time, I'd just like to quickly talk about a little bit of how we plan to do business on this committee. If you've already been in a committee this session, expectations won't be very different. We'd like to start on time. So if you can try to be here at the scheduled time, that would be great. If you aren't going to make it to our committee for whatever reason, please try to let the staff know, let my office know, so that we can plan accordingly. That is helpful. And just a reminder that the mics are live. I assume that the television is working, that we're on video. We're also going over the World Wide Web. So just be careful and understand that what you say is being recorded. And as I heard it said in the committee yesterday, don't fall asleep or pick your nose. So committee staff will provide materials to your offices prior to our meeting, hopefully the day before our meeting schedule. Please bring your bill files and agendas and whatever materials that are brought to your office to our committee meeting, as they've will not likely be an extra copy here at the dais for you when you get here. At this point, I'd like to take a look at our committee rules. You should have a copy of them at your place. They're the rules that are consistent with all House committees, as we try to have consistent rules from one committee to the next so that everybody knows what to expect. If there's any questions about the rules, we'll be happy to entertain those. If not, the chair would entertain a motion to approve the rules as written.
I so move.
Representative Brown moves that we adopt the committee rules as written. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. as I look at this committee, it's interesting to note that there's only two members on our committee that served in transportation last session or have any experience serving on a transportation committee in this process. Four of our members are freshmen, new to the building, new to the process. Geographically, we cover the state pretty well. We have folks from the city, from the metro area, folks from the valley, on the coast, south coast. The coast is well represented. The only geographic area of the state that isn't represented, I would say, is Eastern Oregon. And I've assured the speaker that we won't forget him or his constituents. As you all know, I am new to the committee myself. I did not serve on the Transportation Committee last session, but I followed what was happening in transportation quite closely as it affected my district pretty significantly. I did serve on the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation. As this session began, I sought this committee's chairmanship. It was one that I wanted because I know it's important to not only my district, but to all of the citizens in the state of Oregon. Transportation is key to my district because if you visit Western Washington County lately, you've noticed a significant investment by some of our nations and some of the world's actually largest companies. As we've experienced dynamic growth, the simplest errand in my part of Washington County has become quite a transportation experience. Whether it's a trip to the grocery store, visiting somebody's house, going from Hillsborough to Beaverton, you got to plan that event. These are illustrations, really, of how life has changed in Western Washington County. Am I so naive as to believe that we'll go back to how we were in the so-called good old days? I understand that we likely will not. But it is my conviction that we must build a 21st century transportation system that not only serves my constituents, those of my neighbors, but also serves the economic growth that has occurred not only in Western Washington County, but throughout the state. We have to do that for my constituents, for all the state of Oregon, not just for today, but into the future. Having played a significant role in the transportation package that was passed by the legislature last session and recognizing the resounding defeat of that at the polls, I recognize there's a challenge ahead. As our census has told us, 21% growth in the state of Oregon in the last 10 years. People are moving here. The challenge isn't going to go away. It is a huge issue for the state of Oregon. And I'm sure you've heard it said that there are three types of people in the world. People who work to make things happen, people who want things to happen, and people who wonder what happened. I know the members of this committee definitely don't want to be in that last category, but instead I hope that we can work together to provide solutions to our transportation system. Like all of you, I spent a lot of time on the doorsteps in my community talking to voters. And when this session ends, I want to go back to my constituents and say, with all the conviction in my heart, that we worked for a better tomorrow for them. Perhaps it won't be a simpler transportation system, but I want to assure them that it will be a better transportation system tomorrow. This is my primary purpose for wanting to serve in this committee, serve with you, for the citizens of the state of Oregon, and chair this important committee. Finally, as we begin a new legislative session, I'm committed to working cooperatively and constructively with the governor, with his staff, with Director Krinnikin and her entire management team, as together we address the critical transportation issues of our state, and I trust that those relationships will be a reciprocal one. And with that, I'm honored to serve with each of you, and I promise that we will work cooperatively to get that job done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krupp, would you like to take a couple of minutes or a brief moment?
You should never ask me to take any time at all. You know better.
I think I'll rock
it. Thank you. I am Representative Jeff Krupp, District 37, which is rural Linn County. It includes most everything but Albany. I'm a fifth-generation Oregon farmer. I have been blessed to been elected to serve the people of District 37 a second time now. I was also fortunate to have sat on this committee last session and wanted very much to be here again. And I'm very thankful to leadership for allowing me to return. I share many of your sentiments, Chair. I am from a more rural area that doesn't quite have the depth of transportation issues that you do. However, when I drive in your neighborhood, I experience that, and I know full well the issues that are impacting all of us statewide. And very much looking forward to working with all of you this session and also the governor's office. I think there certainly is perhaps a more conducive spirit amongst all of the legislative body and the governor's office towards being creative and being more aggressive at pursuing options that are available to us in the transportation system. And I truly hope we go there this session. I want to be a part of that, and that's why I'm here.
Thank you, Mr. Krupp. Just a quick, housekeeping note. The early committee meetings of this committee are going to be background informative meetings. We're going to try to bring in stakeholders that have an interest in transportation from a variety of input, from a variety of points of view. We're also going to, if we can work it, bring in some legislative leaders from the past. With term limits, there is quite a turnover in this process, and I think that it served us well to listen to those that have worked on these issues in the past, and we're going to try to make that happen in the next short few weeks. So with that, I'd like to welcome Director Krenkin and whoever else she would like to bring forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Could you just, because of our new committee, can you just tell us short, briefly about where you came from and a little, maybe a short snapshot of your background?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Grace Krenkin. I'm the Director of the Department of Transportation. We have family roots in Jordan Valley from my mom's side of the family and my dad's side of the family from the Forest Grove, Gaston, Hillsborough area. I was born in Quality Hospital and raised in Beaverton, and I've served in many positions. I was a presidential management intern in the Department of Transportation for several years, focused on policy and budget. I have also served staff to the U.S. Senate Transportation Appropriations Committee. I have most recently came from a position at the Department, U.S. Department of Transportation, as the Deputy of Federal Transit Administration. And in between there, I've worked for the City of Salem and the City of Portland. In Portland, I was in charge of, I started as a capital program manager and worked my way up to Deputy of Transportation. And I've skipped around in that. It wasn't sequential, but an Oregon girl, and I'm pleased to be with you here today and have been in transportation. I'm kind of Johnny or Josephine OneNote in transportation, but I love it. So, how was
you.
That, Mr. Chairman?
That was great.
I live in Salem, and I'm pleased to be here today. We have a short quiz at the end of the presentation, so everyone's listening carefully, and you'll need your magnifying glass on some of these charts. Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, we wanted a quick overview today. We'll have a chance to go into systems, conditions of all of our facilities at some point in time. And so this is really an introduction to the department and some of the parameters that are around us and how we operate. So I will not be going into extensive detail on road conditions. I hope that at another point in time we can return to cities and counties, because we have a lot in common with the cities and counties on road conditions, and we share revenues there. And so we've not gone, we're focusing more on an overview of the department itself.
Great, thank you.
And the packet you have in front of you that I'm going to walk through now, and this is less of a presentation by me and more of a sort of leader instruction kinds of things. I'm just going to walk through this packet with you and just start with a mention that the Oregon Transportation Commission is appointed by the governor. They are appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate. We have a five-member commission. We have a new chair, Steve Corey from Pendleton. We have two new members as of, I believe, December. One is Brandy Pape from Eugene, the Pape Group. The other is Gail Ackerman from Portland, an attorney. And I don't know if she's a practicing attorney right now, but that's her profession. Also, Stuart Foster from Medford and John Russell from Portland, who are fairly experienced members. It's a good group. They have a statewide perspective. And we've been, it's the role of the commission to set the policies given the laws that have been passed by the legislature and guidance by the legislature. And they set the policies for the department. We work very closely with the governor. As a result of one of the legislative changes last year, I report to the governor. I was originally hired in 96 by the commission in consultation with the governor. But for the most part, the governor and the commission work together. And if I know the disconnect, it's the first thing I do is tell both of them and ask them to work it out, because it's certainly nothing I can do. The commission approves the budget, passes it on to the governor. The governor then passes it on to you, and everyone has their hands in the process. I'd like to move on to the organizational chart, if I could. We have 9 divisions inside the department. There's a total of about 4,800 full-time FTE over there. That goes up or down. We're holding about 100 positions vacant right now as a result of some reductions that we've been, you know, adjusting to. Actually, as inflation begins to take its bite out of the budget, you have to hold some positions in order to give raises to the others, even at 1 and 2%. But we have about 4,800 overall. The Aeronautics Division was removed from ODOT last session, and they are their own department. So some of you may recall that we had an additional one last session. If I start on the left-hand side of the chart, the Highway Division has about 2,800 people. It has inside of it technical services. For those of you that are out in the regions working with your folks, sometimes they'll say, well, it's in Salem. We've got plans, we're working on it, that's in Salem. Usually what they mean is it's tech services. Tech services handles it, has bridge designers and roadway designers and right-of-way. Those sorts of things are in technical services housed in Salem for the most part. They work quite closely with the field. The maintenance group is housed inside the Highway Division, and I'll be talking to you a little bit later, but in maintenance, your district managers, and we'll get to their numbers here later, are the people to call. They're the go-to people when you're in your district and you want to know if a sign couldn't be moved, what's the deal with this curb cut, if so-and-so moves in here, what's going to happen to the road. Those are the district managers. They're 24-hour people. They're all beepered up, and if an accident happens, they know what's going on. They make the system work. Also in the Highway Division will be 5 regions, and you have a map, I believe, that's been provided you. I don't have one to hold up for you, but you can see the regions, and then within the regions are the districts. That works quite well for us, I think. You get the local response you need as a legislator by having folks identified on the ground that can handle the problems that come up in the areas. And so a region manager handles all of, say, Region 4, which is Central Oregon, and there are several districts inside Region 4. They report to that manager. There are also some special programs inside the Highway Divisions, and they'll be spelled out in the budget presentation a little later. The Safety Division is about 24 people. They handle things like statewide seatbelt initiatives, impaired driving, child restraint, driver education. And the key asset that they bring is that they work extensively with the local communities. You have traffic safety committees in your communities, parents that get together because of bicycle helmet programs, that sort of thing. They're very local. They fund a lot of just local grants out in the communities trying to improve safety. When you have a problem on safety, such as we have on 214 with the death at the crossing the street at the Woodburn, or in Highway 1822, those kinds of things, a targeted effort, the Safety Division comes in. They're largely federally funded, more so than some of the other areas. Public Transit Division has 13 folks. It's mostly a grant-making branch. There's a lot of technical service they provide. There are over 200 transit providers in the state. And to a large extent, they are working with counties, some cities, faith communities, volunteer organizations, trying to strap together local transportation service. And for the most part, in rural Oregon, it is for seniors and disabled. The Motor Vehicle Division has about 900 people in it, about 915, as I recall. They have the driver program, testing programs. They now have an older driver program we will be bringing to the legislature. They work on behavioral things with drivers, as well as a lot of the official regulatory function for titles, vehicles, vehicle registration, driver programs. The rail division has about 27 people in it. They deal extensively with the rail industry. They regulate the tracks, track inspections, labor safety complaints, grade crossings, and they do the scheduling for the Oregon Transportation Network, which has the line from Eugene to Portland, work with Amtrak to contract out through motor coach service throughout the state. In the motor carrier division, that's the trucking world for shorthand, they handle the truck inspections, overdimensional permits, and the rate mile tax collection. The auditing for the rate mile tax collection is actually handled in central services, but for the most part, the trucking industry's primary contact is through the motor carrier division.
How many employees?
And they have about 282. When they transferred over from PUC, I think they were closer to 350, 345, something like that. That's been over 4 years ago, and we've been trying to find efficiencies there all the way through, and as we have, we've tried to reduce the number of FTE, which is true throughout, but in motor carrier, there is a number that sort of is a benchmark when it was with motor carrier, I mean, it was with PUC. Next, we have the Transportation Development Division, about 128 employees there. And it's a poorly understood division. They have a lot of responsibility. We have to collect data from the federal government. We have research programs that are also funded by the federal government. A lot of the statewide policies, if we're going to develop the highway plan, if we're going to overhaul the highway plan, for example, we recently put in what we call special transportation area designations, so the development of statewide policy, statewide planning practices, those are all housed at the Transportation Development Division. The Transportation Growth Management Program is there. That's a program that's operated in conjunction with the DLCD, Land Conservation Department, and they fund a lot of local grants and work with a lot of communities trying to solve their transportation problems, help out with the review of the transportation system plans, and basically provide some contact with some of the other statewide agencies as we're trying to solve problems together. Central Services is a division that has about 560 people in it. There are another 178 that are in a budget limitation called non-limited, but basically those folks are the support services and the vehicle maintenance and vehicle repair side of things. So the four major divisions in the Central Services are Financial Services, Human Resources, Information Systems, and what we call Support Services. We do a lot of contracting out through the Central Services Division. In some cases, it makes more sense for us to have a mechanic located in Bend. In other communities, it makes sense for us to use the local garage for all the equipment they can do. So some of those determinations are made within the Central Service Division. Those numbers for the Central Service Division also include the FTE for the Director's Office and the Communications Division as they are budgeted through that limitation.
So the 560 FTE include the Communications Division?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And the 550 are in the Central Service limitation. Non-limited is sort of money in, money out, and there's another, 178, the number I've written down.
Thank you.
The next page, page 3, has on it DOT responsibilities. This restates some of what I said, probably a little more professionally, but you can go back and look it up. And we also have a program budget, which I'll get to in a minute, just to reference, which has much more detail on the workings of the department. We've also provided on page 4 the a list of people to contact if you have problems. I see not listed on here are the district managers, so we'll get you a copy of those. Those are really the maintenance folks. And if you saw a dead deer on the side of the road and you wanted to call someone, it'd be better to call the district manager than anyone on this page. So we'll get you those numbers, but names and numbers. But what you have in front of you are the region managers and then the area commission. So if you look under the region, if you're in Region 3, it says Paul Mather, Mark Russell, and Monty Grove. It shows the counties that they serve. These are people that help with local governments. They help with the development of the state transportation improvement program, work with the area commissions in the development project. So some of you have approached me and said, we're really interested in getting the Newburgh-Dundee bypass there. Dave Bishop would be the guy you go to and talk to about, you know, what the concerns are and how it gets developed. All of our other divisions are mentioned there, and please feel free to call them. Joan Plank is a government relations person, and Joan, raise your hand around. There you go. On legislative items, she's really the one to go to, and she'll broker the rest of it inside the department. We've highlighted on page 5 a couple of the key issues that we have, and there'll be other opportunities to more fully walk through various issues that are before us. Just as background information, we are the first two items. The population has gone up in Oregon. Population's gone up. The numbers I have were 17% over the last 10 years. Drivers, driving's gone up 21%. There's a theory out there among the public that if the driving's gone up, the money's gone up. Okay. And we'll walk through a presentation, I'm sure at some point in time when we want a little bit more on the revenue, but the truth of the matter is over the same period of time, if you go back even a few years sooner, the VIP, or the MPG miles per gallon, that the fleet, the total fleet of Oregon gets, has gone from about 13 miles per gallon up to 21 miles per gallon. And that's gone down a little bit to an average of 18, I believe, with the advent of the sports utility vehicles that have helped out my cause greatly. Not great for the environment, but they've helped me out. So if you think about it, if you, you know, you burn a gallon of gas, you've paid the state 24 cents for a gallon of gas, and you used to do that 10 years ago, and you get 13 miles, you can now drive, say, 21 miles, and before you put in another 24 cents. And that has really diminished somewhat. That is, the gas taxes have gone up, what's called nominally. If you reduce down inflation and whatnot, the gas tax is pretty much, its earning power has been pretty flat for the last 4 years. And we'll walk through that. I'm sure Dick can walk you through. But by the time you take out its buying power, when you look at its buying power, it's remained relatively flat for us. And really, it's a combination of some of the inflation factors and the population and driving impact with the change in fleet mix. The other item, which we will go into a lot of detail on, I'm sure, and hopefully with in conjunction with cities and counties, is the pavement condition. The pavement condition is our substitute for, if we got the question, so how are things going? We know what condition the pavement's in. We know that we've kept up, and that's, we've set some benchmarks. We have a whole presentation we'd love to give you on how that's changed over time, what it takes to maintain that. But that's really our gauge. And we call it, just for those of you that haven't been speaking, a fair or better condition. There are 5 condition ratings. The terrible one is called very poor. Then there's poor, there's fair, there's good, and there's very good. And if you're in fair or better, that means you're in the top 3 categories. That's where we want to keep the roads, because it costs you a buck to pave a road when it looks okay to everyone. It's in good shape. It hasn't slipped to poor. It costs you a buck to fix that road. If you let it slip down to very poor, it costs you 4 to 5 times as much to fix the road. So we like to keep them up there. You'll hear a lot of that conversation going on. 3/4, about 78% of the roads are in fair or better shape right now on average. We've been trying to hold that number. In terms of the bridges, we have about 25%, about a quarter of the bridges that are not in good shape, and those become very expensive, and if they get so bad you have to replace them, those become extremely expensive. So, you know, moving down to the bridge category, we have about 2,600 bridges in the state. You'll see that when you get to the money, we shifted the money into the bridge and preservation category from the modernization categories, and that's in order to sustain the investment that we have out there right now. Those will be very big issues for us to discuss. State funding, I think we've covered that. We made great gains last year in the transit and rail areas, where we were able to make a $10 million investment of general fund money in the Oregon Transportation Network rail component. That added another train in the valley, and it added bus service to areas of the state, including Bend and Burns, and it bolstered up the line from Astoria. We've added lines from Klamath Falls in Medford, and really added to the network that exists in Oregon today. Another $9 million of general fund was added to transit, and that has allowed transit systems throughout the state to improve their ridership significantly. And their vehicles, they had about 69% of their vehicles were in good shape. And it's moved up, which meant, you know, 31% were not in good shape. And so elderly and disabled citizens were riding in a significant number of vehicles that needed improvement. And we now have moved that number up to 81% as a result of the investments that the legislature made. I think on page 6 it's worth talking about accountability, and we also have a supplemental piece of paper for you that looks like this, the 1999 accountability bills. In the 97 session, which was my first session, I think it's fair to say that was kind of in the soup with the legislature. As a result of that, a bill came out of the session to add some revenue, and then there were a list of improvements that we were supposed to make, and some of them had to do with processes. One of them was to have a Secretary of State's audit. There were several others. The bill didn't pass, ultimately. And so we just, as a department, took all of the improvements that the legislature had included in that packet, and we went and did them anyway, because I felt it was the intent of the legislature to make those improvements. So we went and did, had the Secretary of State conduct an audit. They broke it into four parts. I was also guided by several senators who said that no one's going to believe government can audit government, so we broke off some of those pieces that needed to be done that the Secretary of State's office couldn't do, and we had a private sector audit of our department. We got some very good advice. We implemented that advice, particularly on project planning, project development, and the implementation of our construction programs. What I think is important to note is, though the Secretary of State and the private sector audits had some good things for us to do, there was nothing that matched some of the accusations that I heard during the session. There was no smoking gun. They gave us a pretty good bill of health, and we tried to improve absolutely everything that was listed there otherwise. Nonetheless, about the same time as coming out of the session, I thought we could use some citizen help, and so we instituted an efficiency committee, and I picked up a good number of those members from speeches I would give when they would grab hold of an issue and keep going and going and going. I just said, you know, why don't you come on this committee I'm forming, and you've got, you know, a blank check to come in and guide us through where you think we ought to go. Many people took me up on that offer. I've provided you a list of those efficiency committee members, Pete Namas, Alan Eberlein, Mike Oberdeen, who recently passed away, but has served well on the committee. They've been great. They're sort of inside critics, and they have the time, they've taken the time and made the commitment just as citizens to come in and really walk through everything we do. The managers come in, give their presentations. The members of this committee have been free to go throughout the state, stop into our facilities, and they have. Check out the maintenance, ask questions, look at the equipment, attend hearings, attend meetings. They just walk in the building and walk through our buildings to see if we look like we're busy. They ask questions and kick the tires, literally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krennican, I see that Representative Devlin is on this list. Was he one of those naysayers at a public meeting that you nabbed in?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Representative Rosenbaum. No, he was not. We called over to the legislature and asked for members from the Senate and the House. They were appointed. Some others asked to be added, and we did. Their names are reflected here. Some of them could come a lot more than others, and so Representative Jensen and Representative Devlin were the two that were pretty regular in their attendance, and we're actually giving them credit here. Mm-hmm. And there are several others on here that weren't my junkyard dogs, as I call some of them fondly. We tried to get the stakeholders. You'll see OCAPA on here, and the AGC, and the Trucking Association, and the AAA. Those are institutional folks. I got the broader business members really from the speaking circuit. Thank you for the correction. I really recommend this technique. You've got to want to do it as a director, and you've got to have pretty thick skin because the questions start off at an angle. But it provides us an opportunity to sit down and explain what we do, how we do it, and I think it worked pretty effectively for us. They're honest brokers. We made a lot of improvements, and I didn't have to wait for a bill to pass or something. They come up with an idea, and you can just implement it if it's doable. So. Mr. Chairman, also the program budget, I think, is very much worth noting. I've highlighted it here. This is a copy of the program budget. I believe individually you've received these, but this was through the leadership of Representative John Watt in the 1997 session. He was the chair of our Ways and Means Committee, and we had a typical state budget, nothing against our state budgets, but they are pretty much for the indoctrinated or for nobody. You really have to have a degree in budgetary to state budgetary to understand them, and ours was certainly in Greek, and it was at a higher level than what the legislature wanted. We had two limitations for our entire highway program. We now have 10 limitations for our highway program, and so we took it. Mostly what we did is we went from Greek to English and tried to spell out our program, and that was a very good step. Another step that's not mentioned in our document here but is on this extra list is House Bill 2478. Representative Loken sponsored that bill. It changed a couple of things we do in the budgeting side, but its key change, I think, was the production of the Highway Construction Plan, which has to do with our State Transportation Improvement Program, and I'll get to that in a minute, but there were quite a few changes made in that bill. So I'm sure that the committee will want a briefing on some of these at some point in time, and we'll walk through those. Moving on to the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, we call it the STIP, and I'll refer to it as that. The STIP is really how projects get programmed. So if you're thinking about lane widening, a flyover ramp, even in some cases just a left-hand turn lane, if it's a fairly significant left-hand turn lane that has to be added and real estate needs to be purchased, most likely that would appear in the STIP and go through the STIP planning process. The STIP is a federal document. It's really important for you to understand that because we have federal regulations that we follow, and it's a document that matches the federal fiscal years, which are October 1st to September 30th. The state budget is a two-year document, and it goes from July 1 to June 30th, inclusive of 2 years. And so frequently the life of a project appears in even three STIPs. It may, and the money flows through several budget years. We've tried in the material we prepared for under House Bill 2478, we tried to show a graph of that and how it goes through, and I hope that that particular mystery is solved with the new highway construction plan. I think that it will be. But in development of the STIP, we very much use the local governments. Many projects come from local government. It's their idea. Some come from the operations system, ODOT, looking at ODOT's roads. But many projects can be planned at the local level. They come up to, if we have an area commission established, and I'll get to those in just a minute, they run through the area commission at this point in time. Lists are prioritized. Local governments invited. We have extensive public hearings around the state. And then we publish the document, send it on to the federal government, and they look for federal funds. Does it look like we have the money to do the projects we say we're going to do? And they look at the air quality conformity, which is, do we expect that the projects we have in there will yield an air quality that's acceptable to the federal EPA? It's really a connection document between ourselves and the federal government. It spells out many things beyond just highway projects. It lists local government projects as well, lists transit projects. We're definitely meeting federal requirements when we file that. On page 8, in combination with page 9, I think the map is even clearer. Page 8 lists who you can talk to, but if you look at the map, you'll see that most of the state has organized itself into area commissions on transportation. The model parallels to some extent what we've done in the Portland metro region under federal guidance for a long time, which is the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, JPAC. And the concept is get the cities and counties in a certain geographic area, get the private sector that works in that area, get some representation on a group of folks, meet once a month, and start talking about what are the problems you have and what are the monies that you have available to solve those problems, and then come up with a list of solutions and Eric, if you will, at the local level. Then the commission receives, the Transportation Commission, OTC, receives from the ACTS their suggestions directly to the commission. They don't have to go through me or a staff member. And there's, a much better communication. The other thing that happens is your tax dollars, I think you get a better return on your tax dollar because you don't just have one county running to the commission saying, gosh, this is important. Instead, and this local area of Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County is a good example. There are a lot of needs in all of those counties. They really get prioritized when you have all the counties there, and they begin to understand not just their problems, but the role they play in regional transportation. They understand the individual problems of the other counties nearby, and they understand that in solving some of these problems, you can solve a problem in one area and push it on to another, so there's more of a system approach. It's been extremely helpful to us. If we had some more dough to put on the table there, I think it'd be a more delightful experience. At the local table right now, the money's a little sparse, but the cooperation has been quite significant.
How often do they meet?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the area commissions meet once a month. We try and have a once a month contact. Maybe 10 out of 12 meet in there. May have about 10 meetings a year, something like that. It's fairly regular contact. We haven't been perfect. In some cases, we give them, you know, a 3 weeks notice to get a decision out of the area commission. They'll be sure and tell you we're not perfect on this, but it's relatively new. You'll notice that in some parts of the state, they have not formed an area commission. It is up to the local governments to do that. We continue to work with them and coordinate with them. In some cases, they haven't decided how they want to associate, if they want just 3, 2, 5, whatever. And Lane County has not chosen to join an act just yet. It's kind of a unique experience working with all the commissioners and the local governments down in Lane County, and I think maybe if we could get them to just get together among themselves, that'd be enough of an accomplishment. I don't know, Representative Boundary, of course, as it comes down there to that county, but I've worked with them, and we're doing our best. We have to prioritize transportation solutions with that county, and we haven't yet figured out where they fit. I don't think they've figured out, you know, where they fit just yet.
Representative Devlin?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Cunningham, MPOs are obviously, federal in nature. And obviously in the Portland metropolitan area, you don't have one of the acts. And I would assume that's probably because you have a type of MPO there that's different from what you'd have in the rest of the state, and there may be a lot of reluctance to have a local act also in addition to it. It has the very same nature in the Portland metropolitan area. And actually in Lane County, they have another MPO, and I don't know if that has anything to do with the reluctance to form an act, but how do you see those two coordinating should you have both in existence in an area?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, an MPO is a Metropolitan Planning Organization, and that is a designation from the federal government based on the size of the city, and over 200, if you have a population of over 200,000, I believe, actually over 50,000, you can have, there's one association, but over 200,000, you're designated as the Metropolitan Planning Organization. Both the Councils of Government and the Metropolitan Planning Organization designations work fine. Everyone's very practical about it, and in some cases, the boards are the same, the elected body, so we don't waste any time. It's a very practical operation. Cascade West operates to coordinate it's the Council of Government for the Albany, Lynn Benton area, and I believe they cover Lincoln County as well. And they work as the act. And in many cases, the meetings are the same and the information is supposed to. In the case of JPAC, in the Portland metro area, it covers the need, so we haven't lost any time worrying about that. So I would say it's there, it's a federal, all the professionals know what's there, and we try not to waste the time of the elected officials and the citizenry who come in, so it hasn't been a problem yet. I think, Mr. Chairman, I'll go now to the bubble chart, and you can see why it's called a bubble chart. I did not like this when I first came on at the department, but this was Chairman Henry Hewitt's way of doing business, and I understood him to be my boss, so I got to like it, and now I really do like it. And it's a little technical, but it also works, and if you'll just let me go to the bubble chart itself over here. Money flows in. It's going to be okay for you. Money flows into the department from a number of revenue sources, and the total accounted for is $2.4 billion over a biennial period. I'm not going to walk through all of these, but when you do, you'll see there's a lot of money that flows through our budget that we don't have access to.
The lottery funds come in and they go out to the light rail bonds. I couldn't touch them if I wanted to. I couldn't stop them. I couldn't double them. Couldn't do any of that. It flows through our budget. We're functioning. The Marine Board. We collect the money for aeronautics, even though they're not no longer a part. So the money comes in here, and on this chart we show this is what we get for the counties and the cities based on formulas the legislature has adopted. This is money that flows out to other agencies. We collect some things that parks get and aeronautics and others. Goes out here, and then this is really the budget that I, my family's on the line for. Okay, even included in here are the other $24 million, which is the light rail, as you can see here, and the marine pilots and that sort of thing. So in terms of the money that I focus on with you, it's all right here. The highway division, we've broken out a little bit more over here so that you can see the various categories that are included. This is the budget for this year. We have not yet got to a bubble chart on the governor's proposed, but we the legislature's on it a couple last time, so we're putting that together as well. The colors of money, you can see the federal government has a large influence over the highway program, and if you go to the safety budget, as I mentioned before, that's highly driven by federal funds, somewhat too on the transit side. The driver and motor vehicle and the motor carrier, driver and motor vehicle comes from the your license fees, that sort of thing, and then your vehicle fees. And motor carrier funds are paid for, the budget here really comes from the weight mile tax. There's some, these are sort of off the top of the fund at some point in time. I won't go through that right now, but just gives you a flavor for the funds we have, where it goes, and what the proportions are. Over time, the federal funds, over the last 10 years, the federal funds have had two boosts. One is in 1991 with the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act of 1991, known as ICE-T inside the club. And in number in 1997, the Transportation Efficiency Act for the 21st Century, T21, there was a boost in federal funds. This is the governor's my staff is more efficient than they were yesterday, and so you have before you the governor's recommended budget. This is the governor's recommended budget. My apologies. It has nothing to do with the staff being more efficient. They've always been terrific, but get our work together. Thank you. We have the increase in the federal funds has come at the same time, but the last time the state increased its funding was in 91, which took effect in 1993. So as these new federal funds have come in, we haven't been able to match them and get as much of a boost as some of the other states have. What we've done is kind of backfilled, and we've basically federalized some programs that we didn't used to federalize as our needs, you know, to pay people continue to increase and inflation comes in. So basically, we had more state funds than we used to put more state funds out on the road all by themselves without matching federal funds. Now, more and more, we're matching just about everything we can with federal funds. In a couple of years, and I wish it was a science, it's more of an art, I'm guessing by the year 2004, that's the latest estimate in conversations with staff, we'll come to a point where if they say, and here's some more federal funds, we'll say, sorry, we can't take them because we can't match them. And we've gotten in that squeeze. Part of that has to do with the requirement that we have on us that we have to spend the equivalent of 4 pennies of gas tax on modernization. And we've come to such a point that our modernization program is really funded by, for the most part, by state gas tax money, not by federal funds. And the federal program is really designed, it's best used if it's put on capital programs, and state money is put on preservation jobs. I'm getting into too much science here, but if you hang with me for just a minute more, the reason you want to spend your state gas tax dollars on preservation projects is because you don't have to meet the federal standards if you're not using federal funds. Okay, so your dollar can stretch a lot further if you're putting state money on a state project, and then all the bells and whistles the feds require of you, you can cut some corners, okay? Still be safe, and you are. But if you're using federal funds, you have to build the federal standards. What we have done is try and negotiate with the feds to get some of those standards a little more flexible, get them down. We've prioritized some roads.
but it's better to have more state funds than federal funds, and the more the federal funds become a part of your budget, the more you're building things to a higher standard than one would like to. And you've lost your ability to have judgment. You instead have to substitute your judgment for that of the feds. That will be a big issue for you as we go through time. I want to give you that warning now, because 2004, if we skip this session without an increase, 2004 will be upon us as we speak.
Great. How much does does 1 cent of the gas tax, how much does that raise in the equivalent weight mile?
A 1 penny with equivalent weight mile raises about 24 to, in the future, $26 million. I think $24 million is the number we're operating with right now. And of that right now, we get 60% of existing funds on average. New pennies have been added in the past at a 50-50 ratio, so 50% goes to the state, 30% to counties, 20% to cities. So as we look at it, if we stayed with that deal, you know, the state gets about $12 million a penny. So if you passed a 2 cent tax, we'd have $24 million a year to put toward our system. You obviously have some choices in there, but we've been working very closely with cities and counties to stay there.
Representative Virgia?
Yes, Director, just back to the modernization and preservation, just to kind of clarify for me, the members of the committee, isn't it true that you really emphasize more on preservation than modernization as percentage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that's correct. Our emphasis has shifted, and if you look in this budget, you'll see that shift. I'll get to that in a minute. What I was trying to say is there is a state law that requires us to, and the House passed it last year, the Senate did not, to try and change that. But we could still have us guarantee that we're going to use the equivalent of 4 cents, that amount, on modernization. But if we could even just use our federal funds to meet that need, not the state gas tax dollars, that would allow us to get a better bang for the buck on the money being used on preservation. So that without raising any money, we could get a better bang for our buck if we could just make that small shift. And you wouldn't even have to address, there's still the question out there of modernization. But you are correct. We have shifted our use of funds, our federal funds and our state funds, from modernization to preservation. That's correct, and I'll walk you through that in the budget. We're on the budget on page 11, and I know it's, too many numbers, but if you went down under the construction, there's a maintenance limitation and then a construction limitation, and down there, if you follow the bridge numbers, you'll see in 97-99, we're at $86 million on bridge, and that number is going up to about $140 million if our request were granted. It's gone up over time. The preservation program has gone from $187 million in 97-99, and that's moving up to $291 million, so a $100 million increase. And then if you keep moving down to the modernization number, you'll see that's gone from $303 million, and that's moving down to $189 million. There's a lot of other numbers shifting around, but those are the big shifts that have occurred. And the second thing I point out in here is you can see the investment in the rail and public transit budgets, the transit division. Some of the funds that were there before were federal funds. The rail division's gone from $8 million up to $31 million. Now, that's also got a lot of federal funds in it, but you'll see the reason that's been sustained over time in transit is because the state came in with its general fund money for the senior and disabled services. And the last slide I have is just some fun facts. I know you're thrilled to be part of this transportation. The one I point out is the state only owns 10% of the roads in this state, but 60% of the traffic flows over those roads. So you have to be careful when those counties come in with all their big, huge needs and big miles. Just remember, we still carry 60% of the traffic. Just kidding.
They're up in the back.
We also included, when I say we only own 10% of the roads, we have the federal government, BLM, Federal Forest, they own some roads in the state, and they've actually been very helpful roads over on the coast. Counties and cities own quite a few roads, and you'll see that the numbers are increasing for the local governments, more so than they are for us, in terms of what they've had to maintain, in terms of the numbers of miles over the last couple of years, because the development obviously has occurred mostly in the cities, and on city streets, we've added a number of city streets, so... Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's my brief overview. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions, Ms. Klinikin. One, do you foresee any short-term change in the federal outlook? I mean, is there anything coming up other than a change in administration?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, the numbers for the federal, they ramped up in the 80s, in the first couple of years of the bill, and they'll be flat, I expect, for the next 3 years or so. In 2003, we reauthorized, there'll be a reauthorization of the program, and new targets will be sent then. If they don't increase the gas tax too much at the federal level, or don't increase it at all, I don't expect a huge bump in the federal program. And I don't know of other changes coming. Both the chairman of both houses that authorized these things have changed, Chairman Schuster and Chafee, from the last time. And so we're not really clear on where Congress might go in terms of a transportation program, nor am I clear with President Bush, President-elect Bush, where he might head on those. So.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative.
I'm not here today, but sometime in the future, Mr. Chairman, could we get a discussion of current service level? I know that's an issue on state facilities, but it's also a very significant issue at the local level.
That would be fine with me.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative
Baker. Yes, Director Kroenke. As you know, on the coast, we're connected by bridges, and so they become very high in priority for us. And it's my understanding now that some bridges are being built where the piling is only at each end of the bridge, where you are not faced with the environmental issues of stopping and starting the construction. Is there anything in your plan to look at that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Verger, we have the Endangered Species Act, having listed every river on the fish that are in every river on the coast, and most of the rest of the rivers in the state, we've got quite an extensive commitment to look at our procedures to try and both maintenance and construction procedures to try and change them to adapt to the listing. So in the short term, we do wraps of bridges. You know, when we were at Yuquina Bay, you saw the bridge completely closed, several parts, and on the I-5 bridges we painted. In the case of construction, we try and not have to be in the waterway at all. You really can't help but be in it at some point in time, and so we do it in the season that is the least damaging to the fish, so we've timed that. We haven't been able to design anything to avoid getting in the stream at all. What I believe you're talking about is footings for the bridge, and as much as we can, we now design them to not have to have footings actually in the bridge, so that if you're doing pavement, if you can wrap it up, you're not in the water. But no matter what we do, you're always over the water, close to the water, and we've got to conduct our business pretty much as though we're in it anyway. We try not to, and we can get away with some, we get a much better commitment of permits if we don't have to physically be in the water itself or where the fish may spawn at all and interrupt the habitat. But, anymore, the habitat around the area, you know, even to the point of trees providing shade, the gravel it looks like it's not in the waterway, but at some point in time the river expands to that. All that's very sensitive habitat area, and we have to dance around it a lot.
A follow-up, please. And how does that affect the funding of the construction of the bridge?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Virgil, it doesn't affect the funding at all. No one gives us extra dough to do it. It comes out of our hide. If I used to be able to fix a bridge for a buck and it now costs me $1.50, no one in Washington cares. They don't give me any more money to fix a bridge. What I do is fix fewer bridges or fix fewer miles of pavement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Krenigan, in a committee I was in yesterday, we had a presentation from the Oregon Progress Board on the benchmarks, and at the end of that, they now show a chart that shows public levels of satisfaction with various aspects of services that state government provides. And I think the transportation one was actually pretty close to 70%, something like that, which I was actually surprised to see that it was that high. But but this is not asking you for, you know, polling or anything like that, but I'm curious what your perception is of if the public is aware of how precarious our current situation is, even if they may not totally like where we are now, that things could deteriorate a lot from where we are. Do you have any sense of that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, yes, and I've seen numbers from every time a utility or a local government or a business group does a poll, they share it with us and we get to look at it. I think the rap on us is our polls are quite high. We should run for office with 70% approval. You'd think we'd be really popular. But as it turns out, it was 88% of the population that voted against the gas tax. People want the service. They want more of the service. They don't want to pay anything for it. And if you ask them, what's the condition system, is it pretty good? They say, yeah, it's pretty good. And they don't see much of a problem. And the answer to that, when we come in to show you a pavement program, is I have to pave the road before it looks like it's in bad shape to get the best return on the taxpayer dollar. And so we try and do that, and that if we let the roads go to hell in a handbasket, to use an old phrase, people would then see the problem. But by that time, it would cost us 4 to 5 times as much to fix them. So that's not what I consider responsible public service. So we continue to fix the roads before they get into poor shape, and people don't see the cost. The other thing they don't see is the aging system. And it's kind of hard to get across to people that did some of these polls and stuff. If you go back 25 years to, or 26 years now, but if you go back to 1975, and you talk to, you know, a middle-aged person who's in business out there, they remember back 25 years, okay, to 1950. And in 1950, the difference in the roads in Oregon between 1950 and 1975, there was a remarkable change. The Sunset Highway, Murray Boulevard, you know, from the chairman's area, they weren't there, okay? And the even 99W and I-5, I-82 wasn't there, I-205 wasn't there. If you go back very far, they have seen a remarkable change in that 25-year period. If you go from 75 to 2000, from the public's point of view, not too much has changed in terms of major roads in the state. Now, certainly areas have been developed by all means, but I don't think that the public understands the aging system that we have. We still have those coastal bridges, which cost a huge amount to replace, and so that the word infrastructure really implies stuff you don't see. It's underneath. Nobody thinks about the rebar in a building when you're going up in an elevator. You take it for granted that it's safe. Okay. Nobody thinks about the chunks of concrete that have fallen off underneath the bridge. They don't see those. And so we have a much older system than we had back in 1975. We have an old interstate system that's going to start eating away at us. We have bridges, and none of that is seen nor understood by the public, so they're driving along and they think, yeah, it's not too bad, it's pretty good, give them 70. Don't want to pay for anything more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually had an opportunity to have that experience myself because your staff took myself and Senator Brown to the Ross Island Bridge construction project, which is in my district, and then took us around the viaduct and looked at the supports and how they're crumbling. And it is pretty shocking, and I agree with you totally, but I don't see how the average person would ever see that, and I don't know what we do at a state level to start educating people, but clearly, you know, there's sort of underpinnings, I guess, literally and figuratively, to this system that are really in bad shape. Yeah, I think we need to educate people in that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also point out, just respectfully, please, that the gas tax, every time the gas tax has been referred to the public, and it was referred several times, I think in the 70s, Representative Priestley worked hard to refer them always, I think, every time it gets referred, it goes down. Every one of the 24 pennies that we have in place was put in place by the legislature and not challenged. There were plenty that were challenged, but we've never gone to the voter to get the gas tax that we have in place. I believe in 52 they passed something related to a vehicle registration fee change that had to do with other shifts that were going on, and they voted favorably then. That's been the only time in Oregon history.
That's right. Representative Brown.
Chairman Starr, Director, a question and a comment. When we get federal transportation funds, when they come back to the state of Oregon, do they direct where those funds go, like to transit or to rail or to safety projects? Are they they're directed at a specific use when they come back?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, yes and no. There are various categories of funds at the federal level. There's what we call formula funds. Formula funds come, in some cases, to categories what we call like the National Highway System, which are like the Sunset Highway and Highway 20, Highway 22, I-5. There are funds that come for only interstate maintenance. So the job in Jefferson that you drive through, that's being funded by interstate maintenance. I couldn't use that money on 101 if I wanted to. I couldn't use it to build an improvement on the interstate system. There are categories that come called surface transportation program money. That money comes to both cities and counties, some cities and counties, and to the state. And there's a generic purpose. All of those, you can use it. They don't tell me it has to be used on a Jefferson project in the maintenance case, but it has to be used in maintenance on the interstate. There's also flexibility in between the categories. I can shift all the money ultimately to one category or another. There are some that are discrete, the bridge money. But I have to certify that we don't have needs in the category before I move it to another category at some point, I think at the 50% level, to the secretary. So I would say there's a lot of flexibility. Then I would say there's also discretionary money. Both comes at the discretion of Congress and some of it at the discretion of the administration. And sometimes it looks like it's one, but it's really the other. And those discretionary projects that come are frequently for one project named at one point was in Redmond, the Redmond bypass, the 97 bypass. And when the bill gets authorized every 5 years, that's really when most of that earmarking happens, when they're marking up the authorization of it. For the most part, the program flows over the course of those 5 years through the appropriations process. And there is, once it comes, there's flexibility. So the answer is some of it's marked, some of it's not, some of it's at the state's discretion, some of it's at the federal discretion.
Just to comment on the maintenance problems also that the state of Oregon faces with their highways. And I had the opportunity to work for the department, or highway, it was Oregon State Highway Department at the time from 1958 to 1972. And one of the areas that I worked in was Lane County, and we had a number of bridges along the coastal area then, and this was in the late 60s and early 70s, that had real bad spalling problems with the under-supporting beams and exposing the rebar there at that time. And I'm sure in the 30 years since then, it hasn't gotten a whole lot better.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, it is not. One of the things we've discovered in the meantime, and the ODOT engineers took a technique that was used in another field and applied it here, and it worked. We've taken the coastal bridges, and we save $60 million. Instead of replacing the bridges, we go in and zap it with zinc, put zinc all over it, and change the electric charge. And what happens is the salt starts eating away at the zinc instead of at the rebar. And we did that with the Yacona Bay Bridge. We got to it in time. We did not get to the Alsea Bay Bridge in Waldport in time, and that's why that was a brand new bridge. That brand new bridge, I'm thinking, cost $40 million to replace it. It was put up in about 91, and we paid, I think it was $9 million for the Yacona Bay Bridge by just keeping it in place. Now, it didn't widen it or anything. It's not a four-lane bridge, but it bought us another 15 years for $9 million, and it was estimated to cost, in the $30, $40 million range to replace the Yacona Bay Bridge. And we never could have put up a bridge that's got that signature for Newport that the Yacona Bay has.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Grace, a couple of things. The last session, Representative Crummell and I put forth a bill to study the possibility and feasibility of building an interstate freeway or a toll road through central Oregon from state line to state line. What's the status of that?
Representative Starr, excuse me, Chair Starr, Representative Krupp, we have a study that will be coming back to the legislature. We were requested to report back here, and I believe the study is being completed. We are checking through all of the to-do lists for us, and I don't know the outcome of the study itself. I do know that we'll be back to you fairly shortly. And Senator Carno has also expressed some interest in that as well on the Senate side.
Wonderful. Mr. Chair, follow up, please. Thank you. How big of a problem would I create for ODOT if I were to introduce legislation that would, in essence, have ODOT leave the central lanes that you have, the temporary center lanes that you have placed in the I-5 construction project from Jefferson up north? What problems does that create for you? And the reason I'm saying that it is because I hear a lot from folks driving down I-5 that the plan is for us to remove all of that fill and all of that pavement that we've put in there on a temporary basis. I understand the temporary bridges will certainly have to go, but for future planning of perhaps expanding I-5 to three lanes, or perhaps the crazy idea of putting high-speed rail down the middle of all of that, it just seems to me that logically we ought to leave that rock base there if nothing else, and let it be something that we can build upon for the future. There's a phenomenal amount of money and effort that's gone to put that in there, and it seems to me it's kind of a waste to pull it out. So am I going to create real problems?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, are there any feds in the audience? Seriously. Okay, well, let me just say, when you go to fix a road, in this case, that stretch of road, we couldn't just put an overlay on it the way we did when we had fetid tire damage to the road between Portland and between Salem and Wilsonville. We put an overlay on that and fixed for about $6 million both sides of the road. And it'll last, and the studs will eat away at it still, but it was relatively inexpensive. When we go to fix the route from Salem to Jefferson or on down to Albany, there's a stretch in there that's got, hasn't got a great base to it, and the truck volumes that have been carried there have been such that we've eaten away at it. So we used interstate maintenance money to completely rebuild that down to the base. You couldn't just stay with the concrete base that's there. And to do that, because of the disruption, we couldn't get everything down to one lane, you know, and fix two lanes and then get everything down. So we put that center line piece, and largely because we have to do the northbound job and the southbound job. So the job that's going on now is the northbound job.
That's correct.
And we built this center piece that would handle the traffic during that time period, and it can be used twice. We'll keep it in place, and then we'll go do the southbound project, and it's very useful. At that point in time, it'll be 8 years old, okay? And we'll go to the feds. Right, if we had said what we'd like to do is add two lanes, okay, and that wasn't what we had in mind, but if we'd said we'd like to add a lane in each direction or a couple lanes in there, the feds would have said, fine, that's interstate construction money you need to use. You can't use maintenance money to do it. So ODOT very appropriately said, well, what we want to do is we've got to refix this. So when we get all done, then we'll go to the feds, having done both ways. The pavement will be 8 years old, and we'll say, you know, this pavement is good for 30, 40 years. You want us to tear it up, or could we get a good return on it if we incorporate it somehow into the volumes going on? Now, that would also have to be a discussion that was had with all the parties involved, you know, because at that point it would be a modernization project. You would have to prioritize hooking it up and making some changes, but we would have that conversation before we tore it up. Now, at that point, the feds would say it served its life as a maintenance function. You put it in as a maintenance project, and it made sense, and the feds know, you know, they see the costs for carrying it up, and then we'd have a discussion as to the appropriateness of reusing it, if you will, in the modernization world. Keep in mind that we have other demands on us in terms of hooking it up, number one, and in terms of expanding the capacity there, the issue of the high-speed rail line and its function versus the highway would have to be discussed with all parties involved, Salem, Albany, you know, all of that. So if you pass legislation, it would cause me problems because the federal statutes tell me I cannot do that. If you hang in there for the next couple of years and we change the, you know, term limits thing and that's gone and you're here in 8 years, whatever it is, then I think that discussion is much more practical and we've gotten our maintenance use out of it. And then it's a question of, is it worth taxpayers' money to tear it up, or is it better use of taxpayer dollars to utilize it in some other fashion?
And one last quick question. Sure. Are you saying then that the base rock that you placed in that temporary lane right now, should that be considered in 8 years solid enough that you could build the proper type of roadway on top of it, much as you're doing in the other lanes right now? That base is good enough to do that, accomplish that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krupp, that's correct. And what I'm saying is, if you ask my people on the ground what's supposed to happen, they're supposed to tell you that we tear it up.
And that's my reason for the question.
The quality of what's there is my understanding. It's good quality, temporary stuff.
Thank you, Director. I appreciate that.
Representative Lawson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Crimpton, I admire your leadership in this department, and I think you've done an excellent job. And I also wanted to thank you for Joan Plank and Kelly Taylor, who gave us excellent orientation. We knew people really needed it, and it was just great these last 9 months. Thank you very much, and the excellent information and the follow-up. And at present, very important to my district is knowing what happened to the last 4 cent increase, and I'm appreciating very much that Joan is working on this study for us. As you know, our citizens, you know, feel a need to know, you know, what those funds were used for, and certainly, as you know, about 88% of our county was not in favor of this 5 cent tax for the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. So we'd just like to show them what really happened with the last increase, and I think that means a lot when we get that information back. So I'm going to appreciate that. Do we presently have a program and designated funds for the safety corridors that have been identified in the budget?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, we have a safety program where we have funds set aside that you're not doing a preservation job, you're not doing a modernization job. There's a safety issue, standalone safety issue that needs to be addressed, and we have funds that can go just to safety. And those funds try and address what's called the high priority safety area. So if there's been the highest priority, we pick them off from the top. We take the highest accident areas and just keep working the list down. And as time goes on, some new ones come on, but new issues come on. But we start at the top and work our way down. In the case of the corridor 1822 area, we've been making investments working with the local community. And we've looked at the three E's. In transportation, we talk about the three E's, engineering, the enforcement, and education. And in the case of transportation safety, some of it in that corridor is education, letting them know that traffic volumes have gone up, and working with the local communities and you know exactly how to operate on there. A good amount of it's been in kind of re-engineering some solutions, trying to put in some as close when you get closer to Salem, the barriers that are up, and then working with law enforcement to try and get some improvement. So we've targeted that corridor. The short answer is yes, there's money available. It has to be prioritized, and we'll work with the local community to do that. So I believe it'd be yes to what you're asking.
Yes,
also, since we do have that Great Spirit Mountain Casino on that Highway 18, are there funds through the VIA or any other organization that can assist in maintaining that safety corridor or enhancing it? Chair Starr, Representative Nelson, we have been working with the tribe, the Grand Ronde tribe, to make improvements there, and they paid for all of the improvements right there for Grand Ronde.
Yes.
And I have got someone looking into the BIA itself. I don't believe that there is a separate pot of funds to address transportation needs that can go directly to the tribes. The question is there any money that they get that can be applied somehow? And I don't know the answer to that one right now. We're looking at that.
Just one more, Mr. Chair, please. You know, employment is very close to my heart and the concern of, you know, our 83,000 citizens in Yamhill County. And as we've lost over the last 4 years, four
of our major businesses, and transportation is key, as I mentioned in the introduction. And certainly with this new Spruce Goose Museum, we anticipate some 400,000 visitors who will begin coming to this museum over this year when it opens in three or four more months. And certainly, we're certainly anxious for those visitors to come in and leave their money and be able to leave quickly then after they've left their money. I wonder, you know, for the benefit of our citizens and our businesses, that beyond the environmental study for this bypass, where is the basic hang-up on moving ahead? Are we number two on the STIP, and are there actual factual contractual dollars dedicated to the Newburgh-Dundee bypass?
Chair Starr, Representative Nelson, the Newburgh-Dundee bypass is an idea whose time hasn't come yet in the construction budget, but in terms of the beginning of the process where we do an environmental impact statement, that's where we are, is working on the environmental discussions. And those discussions include looking at the range of options that are available to you to you know, put the highway in, and reaching consensus at the local level, and then environmental documents who's damaged by which alternative and what mitigation you can put in place. We are in the I believe we've scheduled money to fund the environmental work. No commitment has been made on the construction of that. We don't have any dollars to put toward a project that's not defined yet. But the project itself has been discussed extensively at the Area Commission on Transportation. And so, in that sense, I think it is a priority of the Area Commission on Transportation, and I know it's come before the Commission a great deal. So what's under contract or actually scheduled would be the environmental work, not the construction work. We wouldn't be able to do that till we finish the environmental work. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
I hope to have you and your staff in front of our committee in the future to maybe have some more in-depth discussions of your budget and other programs.
We appreciate everything you've done and appreciate your opening remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to ask Joan Robinson from Westside Council to come and introduce herself to our committee. Joan earned her law degree from Rutgers University School of Law, and she began work in the Oregon Legislature in 1977 as a committee administrator, has worked in Westside Council since 1982. She has been an invaluable legal resource for us on the transportation issue, and I'd like to welcome Joan. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are kind of in a little bit of a time
crunch. Right. I know how to do it fast. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Joan Robinson, Chief Deputy Legislative Counsel. I appreciate the opportunity to introduce myself to you. Obviously, I don't know those of you who are new. I understand that most of you have spoken with Greg Chamoff, the Legislative Counsel, about what our office is here to do for you and how we can help you. And I hope that you will. So I know you will use our services. I don't think you have much choice, actually. Unless you're not going to request any bills or any amendments. Assuming you will request bills and amendments, you will most likely be coming to me if they deal with transportation, unless they have to do with boats. I don't do boats for some reason. And I don't do mass transit. That's a local government issue primarily. This session, I have a staff attorney working with me, Catherine Zinkman. She joined us in September, I believe, and has gone through our training process, is doing an excellent job helping me draft bills. So if you're not dealing with me, you'll probably be dealing with Catherine. Our job is to do legal work for the legislature, and as I sat here and listened to the questions you asked, Grace, I thought, well, this is a good opportunity to tell you that most of the questions you asked, Grace, are not questions I could answer, although they're questions that are frequently asked of me. I can answer your legal questions, and if I can't answer them, I can find the answer. If I can't answer them off the top of my head, I tend not to make things up if I can avoid it, although I've been known to do it. Questions about how much does a 1 cent increase in the gas tax raise, or what's the status of the Newburgh-Dundee bypass project, or what's the status of the freeway in Central Oregon, are not questions that I can answer off the top of my head. if you ask me those questions, I will try to find the answers. But I'll go to the same people that you could go to more directly. It's, and I understand that you're not going to know whether a question is a legal question that I can answer, or a policy question, or a fact question, or what. And I'm certainly not going to turn you away if you come and ask me questions like that. But I just warn you that sometimes I might say to you, is it all right if I call John Plank, or I think you'd be better off asking John Leon, or whoever the expert, the local expert is. I want to just give you a sense of our workload for now. As I was leaving my office, one of my colleagues said, well, what do you want to tell them, John? We're here to serve you, but don't bother us. Now, that's a strange message, isn't it? And it's not near the message I want to leave you with, in spite of the fact that I'm just about to tell you how busy we are. As of last Friday, January 5th, we had received 2,393 requests for bill drafts, measure drafts. That includes bills and resolutions. It does not include research requests and opinion requests. From now until the deadline for requests, the House deadline for requests, which is February 12th, we will receive another between 1,800 and 2,000 bill draft requests. The same number of people that we had, starting in September when our staff attorneys joined us. So almost half our workload is turned out in the first 50 days of the session. So that means that we don't always have time, as much time to spend as we might like to spend talking with you or sitting in and listening to the committee. We all have televisions we can monitor, although as I get older I get less good at doing two things at once, listening and drafting a bill. So we will be pretty busy in the next few weeks. What that means a few things. I believe we always get out every bill that's requested. And in the time that I've been at Legislative Council, our lot has improved considerably. When I first came, the deadline for requesting House bills and the deadline for introducing House bills was the same day. So you could bring in a request at noon in theory, and we'd have to get it out to you at 5 o'clock for you to drop it at the House desk. Now we have a week. And to some extent, we even have 2 weeks. So that's a major improvement for us. I will try to answer a couple of the frequently asked questions about bill drafting. One is, how long does it take to draft a bill? What can you expect if you come to my office today with a bill draft request? And I hate to sound like a lawyer in some ways, but the answer to the question is that depends, of course. What else could the answer be? It depends on the complexity of the request. It depends on the clarity of the request. How much information have you given me? How much do you know about it? How much do I know about it? How much of the lobbyists you've sent know about it? A lot of different things. It depends on how long it takes me to get further information if I need further information, which is my opportunity to put in a plug for you please to return calls from Legislative Council as soon as you can. I know that you are all extremely busy also, and so sometimes we just miss each other for a long time. But if someone from our office calls you, it's almost certainly going to be about one of your bill draft requests seeking further information, and so the sooner you can get back to us, the better. And we like, if possible, to speak personally with legislators requesting bill drafts, but if you're not the one who knows the most about it, if it's a lobbyist or someone else, then we're happy to speak to them. Whoever, as long as you've authorized the lobbyist or constituent to speak with us, then that's fine. If that's the person who knows most about the request, then we're happy to talk with that person. And another thing that it depends on, of course, is how close to the deadline we are. And that's one of the realities of bill drafting in a time-sensitive situation, is the closer we are to a deadline, the less time we have to spend on a bill draft. And that does affect the quality of the draft. There's no question about it. It's unfortunate, but it's true. And the way to insert some quality control into the process, more than we have in our office, and we do have a lot in our office. We have copy editors who read every draft, and they do an excellent job. But they can't catch everything. So I like to urge people to read bills. And I know it sounds odd to urge you to read the bills, but you've already presumably been a little bit overwhelmed by the number that have already been introduced. A huge number of bills get introduced, and you probably can't read them all, and maybe your staff can't even read them all. But if you read them, if the interested parties, the stakeholders read them, if the staff reads them, there's more chance of producing a workable law. The more people read it, the better the chances that we'll get a workable law, and that's, I think, what we're all after. At least that's what I'm after, and I assume what you're after. If you come to see me about a request and I ask you why you're making that request, it's not, I'm not challenging your policy decisions. I'm one of, I and other people in my office are among the few people in this building who are not into policy decisions. We won't tell you what we think of your ideas. If I ask you why, it's generally so I can get a better sense of what you're trying to accomplish, so that I know the direction that you're going and I can get you there, because my job is to draft a bill that accomplishes what you want to accomplish. And I haven't done my job if I don't understand what you want to accomplish, if there's a miscommunication or I haven't asked the right questions, then I'm not going to be able, except by accident, to draft the right bill for you. So I'm not challenging your policy decisions. Yesterday I had a meeting with a lobbyist, and he said, after we talked about what he wanted, he said, well, would you like to know why this is a good idea? And I said, no, thank you. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated his asking the question, but that's different from knowing why he wanted it, in a way. The second question that we're frequently asked is, why is my bill draft so long? You come in and you've given me a neat little idea that takes you 1 minute to explain to me, and then you get back a 20-page bill, and you think, what's going on down there? Don't those people have anything to do? Frequently, as you can imagine, an idea that doesn't take very long to express nevertheless involves a lot of statutes. It becomes complex when you start looking at the statutes. The Oregon Constitution requires that every statute that's amended be set forth completely in the bill. So even if you're making a one-word change to a statute, the whole statute has to be there. The Motor Vehicle Code has an extremely long statute, ORS 809.410, which deals with suspension of driving privileges. Very long. So if you make a one-word change in that statute, your bill is going to be 5 pages long. And that's, well, I was going to say that's unfortunate. I don't know if it's unfortunate. It takes people by surprise sometimes. But usually your bill didn't turn out long because we wanted it to be long. It turned out long because it had to be long in order to accomplish your idea. So, but it does surprise people. So I try to prepare you for that. The third question, and it's not frequently asked, fortunately, is why doesn't my bill draft do what I wanted it to do? And I don't get that question very often, and it's, of course, it disturbs everybody in our office when that question is asked, because our goal is to make sure that your bill draft does do what you want it to do. If it doesn't, the most likely reason is that there's been a failure of communication. We haven't understood correctly what you're trying to do. If I know or suspect that a bill draft that I've done for you is not going to look like what you expected it to look like because of the way the current law is, I will try to write a note saying, here's what it looks like, here's the reason it looks like this, and here's how it accomplishes what you wanted to accomplish. And I think other people in my office try to do that too. But sometimes we just haven't understood you correctly. And if you think your bill draft doesn't do what you intended to do, go back to the drafter and say, here's what I intended and here's what I think this does. And we hope that if it happens, we hope it won't happen, but if it happens, we hope that it will happen early enough in the session so we can fix the problem that we've created. Beyond that, I have always enjoyed working with transportation committees. I look forward to working with this one. I have to say that House Transportation has a history of inviting me to its party at the end of session, so, you know, I'm not suggesting you have to follow it. thank you. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to...
We actually are going to have to... because we had the Republicans need to get on the House floor. I did want to take the opportunity to recognize the distinguished member that walked into the back room to our hearing here, and that's Representative Bob Montgomery, who's seat I'm sitting in, but due to term limits and that event, I got this seat, he's sitting there. I'd just like to recognize Bob and welcome him. And the work that he did. With that, we will adjourn.
I don't know. I will see that majority on. I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know. I know we got to do it.